But my introductory words were true. This is the holiest day of secular religion in the United States of America, quite aside from Ronald Reagan's 100th birthday. This is our great national day of communion, where people across this vast land, more than 80% of Americans, will watch some Super Bowl today. And more than 75% will be passed out by the time it ends. And all will be bored by the time it starts if you've watched all the pregame panoply. But it is secular religion. People keep asking me as a Unitarian Universalist, is Unitarian Universalism a religion? And I keep telling them that the answer to that is, yes, we are religious. And they say, but you don't have a normative, prescriptive theology. You're unconstitutionally vague. And I say, yes, that's right. And our second hymn, when we're talking about anointed people to make all of these visions come true and the lines that come down, justice like water, we really combine the secular and the religious, and we normally kind of understand the difference. America, to a large extent, doesn't, and so the Super Bowl is our great communion across racial, class, ethnic, religious lines. We are involved in this great religious struggle of good against evil. Now, of course, my team is good, and those who root for another team are rooting for evil, and we understand that, and being Americans, we are mildly tolerant of this. We do understand that Satan covers the point spread, so it's not an absolutely Manichaean system of good and evil, because if there's a point spread between the two, it kind of fudges things. We take our communion, not with wine and bread, but with beer and guacamole. But it's the same function as religion. It's ritual. It's people being bound together with common passions, sharing food, hearing music, getting all excited over something that may or may not have any particular intrinsic value, but it is for the experience. And this being America, you have not only food and not only music and not all of those various rites, but given the fact that you have alcohol, men, testosterone, you also get to celebrate violence there on the screen. It basically is society in microcosm. And almost everyone who looks at how crowds act knows that this is indeed a kind of secular religion that becomes passionate, and where the crowd can become a mob and be moved by ideas and values that can be as capricious and arbitrary as whatever teams are playing. I can root for one team one year and another team another. I may care about it, or I may be swept up in the passion of the room. It says a lot about us, a lot about how we understand religion, and what it means to be tied into a passion where one loses one's self and is connected with something that feels greater, that it has no intrinsic worth, is kind of my point here. We get confused about what is valuable, what is worthy, and what is worship. Worship being from the root word of worthy. Things that are of worth intrinsically that can get held up to our attention as a kind of inspiration. At this level, I have to tell you, the Super Bowl is an utter failure. You only get the mob part and the passion part. But that is part of what a religious experience is for many people. When you look at what religions do, as opposed to theories, there are usually two elements. One of them is ecstatic. It is being moved emotionally, being moved by by music, by liturgy, by a sense of being together, by a struggle for a common purpose. And that's the emotional part, the ecstatic part. And every religion has this element that tries to connect people with each other and with some source of energy greater than self. And almost every religion also has a rational component, a legal component, usually expressed in the sermon, though occasionally sermons can become ecstatic in some traditions and irrational in other traditions. But most of the time, the sermon is an attempt to explain law and to exhort people into some kind of action, so that religion tries to appeal both to the emotional component and to the legal component, the rational component that talks about how should we be together. Most religions believe that the law is something that was uncreated and eternal, and it was handed down as holy writ to some very special prophets, but that law can be very vague and may need some explanation and interpretation. So you have Ezra in Hebrew scriptures setting up the first pulpit, building a pulpit in front of the Watergate, the first historical mention of Watergate, by the way, and he explains the law to the people, and this clearly implies that the law is not self-evident. It is open to interpretation. People, even back 2,000-3,000 years ago, knew how to spin the information to their own advantage. And so there had to be some kind of coherence that was brought to it. Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount still explains the law and says not to change a jot or a tittle of the law, and that it isn't enough simply to follow the law, you need to want to follow the law. It's got to be not just part of your actions, but part of your motivation. But all of these show that the historic tradition has been, there is a revealed truth that needs interpretation. And the critical issue, of course, is what do we mean by revealed, what do we mean by truth, and who's going to get to interpret it? Which brings us to us and the Constitution and our founders and our framers and our modern conservatives and Tea Party people, and the veneration and adoration of the founders and framers as if they were ancient prophets who had received the truth, the eternal, uncreated truth of the Constitution. Now, I'm not attacking the Constitution. I'm going to attack some interpretations of it, but I'm not attacking the Constitution, but I am just at times bemused by the people who are holding up the framers of the Constitution as holy, secular, and not so secular saints who received the divine, uncreated Constitution from on high. Because if you believe that, you have to believe that God is a stand-up comedian and has a tremendous sense of humor, because God gave and revealed the Constitution mostly to deists and not to theists. Now, the theists have an explanation for that, and that is the Lord works in mysterious ways. But I love the irony of that. And we hold up these people to have been perfect until we actually look at them. They were bright, they were intelligent, they were perceptive, but saints, slave-owning saints, I got a problem with that. That's not just a question of all times and standards change. When you own and sell and buy human beings, I have a problem in believing in the eternal perfection of you. You're a person. And a lot of bright people, a lot of caring people, but did they expect that constitution to be eternal and unchanged? Well, apparently not, because they very quickly allowed amendments to it. And those amendments now are, some of them have made holy writ from conservatives, and some of them are considered questionable. When we talk about the Constitution and the founders and framers, who were all white and all male and mostly rich and property owners, we have to say that our society has to some extent gotten better, gotten more generous, that our eyes, our vision, our minds, our hearts have opened up beyond the vision and original intent of the founders and framers, which is why I find this veneration and adoration that wants to fix them as something superhuman to be contradictory and morally as well as philosophically questionable. It has the same issues in looking at the Constitution what our religious doctrine interpretations have. And the Constitution was written in English just a bit over 200 years ago, as opposed to our religious scriptures that were written or revealed or received 2,000, 3,000 years ago in other languages by cultures that really were pretty different. So when we get these great, really theological debates between, should the Constitution be read as an organic, living document, or should we try to divine the original intent of the founders, and that is the holy thing, to figure out what was Jefferson thinking? What was Hamilton? What was Adams? What were they all thinking when they were working and wrestling together with this stuff? What did they intend? Well, when we look at passages, we see what the problems are with trying to go back to original intent. If you go back to original intent, women don't vote. People of color do not vote, do not hold property, do not have freedom. Can we magically go back to these framers and say, but if they live today? Well, I guess we can. But we can also look at the greater issue of intent of a document that was made to promote liberty and assure domestic tranquility. And in our own minds and hearts, when we look at a text, look for the deeper meaning and not necessarily the intent of the founders and the framers, but what we need to do to be better and make a better country and a better nation, and incidentally, better selves by opening ourselves up. When we look at our various scriptures, we understand that there are always problems of interpretation. If we look, and there's no sentence that is so simple, either in Bible or in the Constitution, that we can't spend a semester wrestling with it, or a year fighting about it. So that when you're dealing with the issue of all men are created equal, well, you can do three semesters on that. Was the original intent men? Yeah. Was the original intent all men, really? Counting people of color, counting Native Americans and Africans and Asians and North Africans? No. Do we want to stick with the original intent? That seems to me to be not simply morally incoherent, but wrong. What do the words say? What do they mean? Mr. Justice Scalia and Madam Justice Ginsburg read exactly the same words on exactly the same parchment, and they're completely different constitutions. Mr. Justice Scalia does not believe that the Constitution and the framers had any intent or gave any particular rights to women. Madam Justice Ginsburg, for some reason, sees things differently. What do we believe? Well, we know what we believe. We know that we believe that our scriptures, holy however we understand them, whether our foundational documents or our religious scriptures, were laws. They were laws that people at a particular time thought were useful. In our scriptures, they are surrounded with decoration of poetry and of myth that gives it a divine provenance so that, well, we follow the laws just because it has a divine origin. But we still have to wrestle with what it says. When people ask that great question, what would be wrong with having the Ten Commandments on the walls of schools? Well, which Ten Commandments? There are two iterations in Hebrew Scriptures of the Ten Commandments. And even the simple stuff like, thou shalt not kill, doesn't say thou shalt not kill. It says thou shalt not murder. And so we can discuss for a semester the difference between murder one, capital murder, murder two, negligent homicide, and manslaughter, because even that simple sentence is open to interpretation from conservative to moderate to liberal. The others are equally sometimes vague. Let me just give you the sexiest one so that you'll remember. The one that says thou shalt not commit adultery doesn't actually say that. Don't anybody get excited. It does say, it says lo tinnef, which is don't have smoke coming out of your face. Now, most people have understood that as don't get carried away with your passions, whether anger or sexual or in America where you can't tell the difference. You should manage your appetites, but it's not as specific as our translation. When we look at all of those various commandments, they're open to interpretation. And when we, and incidentally, before someone in the talk back points out that all men are created equal is not from the Constitution, but from the Declaration of Independence, I know that. But there are things in the Constitution that are equally open to interpretation. And so that it matters. Where these come together decisively and where why it's relevant to all of us is around personal responsibility. It is not enough to say, the Bible says it, I believe it, it must be true. You have to see what the Bible says, understand for yourselves, and take responsibility. To say, it is in the Constitution that this or this or this can happen or is permissible or is forbidden, is the same thing. We have to take responsibility for what we see and what we understand, knowing that those documents, even those same black marks on yellowed parchment are the same, but our understandings, our interpretations are different, and how we understand and what we do with that understanding is the critical issue. One last thing on the great founders and the sense of irony. I love the fact that many serious and some frivolous conservatives and Tea Party people have raised those founders up as being the be-all and end-all of secular prophethood. And I am struck by the fact that they are so impressed by these highly educated intellectual elites whom under most circumstances they don't trust at all. Go know. To me, this day, bringing us together with beer and guacamole and thought and challenges that are ahead of us, it's an important reminder that when we are together, when we are tied together, when we are bound together as a corporate entity, and I don't mean corporate the way the Supreme Court meant as an individual, I mean in a body of people, we retain a couple of things that are very important. We may be moved by a crowd. We may be caught up in music and passion and enjoy letting go and feeling a part of a great movement. It was hard for me to look at North Africa and Egypt and not to feel some sense of connection and being caught up in the passion and for the moments in the hope, and a hope that I still retain. But we retain our moral responsibility. Our religious documents, our foundational documents, our Rorschach tests, those ink splatters are the same, but they're not the same to everyone. We project and we see and we are motivated by what we see, and we always need to approach all of our understanding with a good dose of humility, of self-examination, of asking how our understanding fits in with our values and how they stimulate us to act in a morally complex and politically complex world. There's great wisdom in all our scriptures. We Unitarian Universalists celebrate that diversity, and we search for that wisdom, and we search for that wisdom to inform our hearts. And we are responsible for using our minds in doing intellectual, ethical, and moral triage of what it is that we see and what it is that we read. Because ultimately, those final choices come down not to our instincts, although our moral instincts may play a role, but they come down to the conscious, examined choices we make that makes such a difference to each other and the world.